It looks like it's just about time for us to begin our Bible study. So if everyone could pull out their Bibles, move over to the 25th chapter of Exodus. We'll be digging into that in just a moment. Exodus 25. Before we begin our study, let's all bow together to our Maker in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time that we share together in study. Help us to understand your message. Help us to build our perception of hope so that the things that we long for in Christ drive our decisions. And help us to be more faithful to you. Help us to share our hope in heaven with others. Help us to lead people to Christ and to demonstrate and show the power of the cross in our day-to-day activities. Please forgive us of our sins, and we offer this prayer in the name of your Son. Amen. All right, so as we talked about in some fashions last class period on Wednesday night, we're going to expand that a little bit more and continue to look into aspects of the tabernacle. At times, we'll think about them in an interchangeable sense with the temple, and even though the temple is historically further out, the principles that come forth from this section of the law are tied together to that. But right now, we're going to talk about the tabernacle side. Because that's the immediate context and the immediate events that are laid out here. Another thing to connect to is that the time frame from the deliverance of the information of this law and the next steps for Israel is pretty compressed. There's not a lot of space between them receiving this information and them moving forward with the next stages of their maturing process, of their growth process, their future rebellion, and then the wilderness period, which is the next larger segment in the story of God's people. There is, though, a lot that happens in that small amount of time. Something to think about is to kind of consider how we look at the Bible. This is my Bible, and so it's got about this much thickness. You think about where the Old and New Testament split takes place. We're looking right about, approximately here, a page or so off. So, top is the New Testament, bottom is the Old Testament. We're talking about the historical side of where we're at right now. You got about that much of a difference, approximately. So, we've got this much of the story of God in play. You know, that's a little bit of Genesis. It's all Genesis and a little bit of Exodus right there. So there's a whole lot more of history and of God's work with Israel that's going to be laying itself out for us. And the Bible's record doesn't always go as an equal sharer of pages to days. If you break down it this way, in Genesis, just in Genesis, you cover everything before the flood, creation all the way up to the flood. Now, those are massive events in the history of God's people and of the creation, right? Like, those are transformative things. Then after the flood, you go forward and you really kind of move up to the scattering, wherein you have the Tower of Babel and the spread out. And from the scattering, you have the rise of the patriarchs. Okay? That gets us through Genesis. You know, the patriarchs kind of close off at Genesis because the next thing that happens is where we're at right now. Exodus and the arrival of the law. Then you're going to have judges. Then you're going to have the kingdoms, the united kingdom and the divided kingdom. And then you're going to have captivity and return. And then you're going to be at Malachi, which is the edge of the silence, if you will. Malachi to John is the quiet period of the Old Testament, where there's not a lot of record of God's prophets, other than looking back and saying, "You guys waited. You guys waited." The New Testament text tells us that they waited impatiently, and they looked. So when we condense ourselves back down to the building of the tabernacle and the structure of the details, like we've emphasized, this process of worship will last from reception all the way up to the arrival of the Messiah, the Christ. And the implements they build are going to have a growing sense of significance. One of those things we've talked about in class in particular was the Ark of the Covenant. And we made a connection to the process by which God would stipulate for its movement. Put it on the poles, Levites are then involved, you know, people who are not authorized shouldn't be touching it. And you think about that in a sense of what you and I think about the Ark of the Covenant. There's some great spiritual connections in this Ark of the Covenant that we can gather. Raise your hand, though, if you've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark. How much did that image and the images of the Ark change at times the way you thought about the Ark of the Covenant? Sometimes you find it creeping in. Anything we bring in, any information we process into our minds, it kind of lingers. It stays. God built us to have a memory feature, if you will. It doesn't always work well. Admittedly so for all of us. We forget things. God even tells men of the New Testament to encourage people to remember the Scriptures, remember these things. And so we have failings there. But there's some powerful good aspects to that visualization of the Ark. And I'm not talking about the last scene in the movie where it's all awful and doomsday-y. That's a separate issue. You got a chance to see in a pretty clear way some of the physical structures of the Ark. And they actually did a pretty good job overall of representing a lot of that, didn't they? It's pretty close. A lot of things in the Scriptures aren't detailed out for us. It doesn't tell us the intricate inlays that may have been there, exactly what they looked at. But they gave us a good simulation of it. Now we ask a different question, though. Now that we have a visual of it, what was the purpose of the Ark in the midst of this holy place? What was supposed to be inside there? Yeah, a few different things there. So there's the stone upon which the law was written. What else goes in there? Anna, anything else? A showbread, Aaron's rod that budded. So those are some powerful things, right? That go in there from the stance of, are they special in and of themselves? Does that law on this tablet, does the Aaron's rod that budded, does anything else that got put in there, does it innately, and I'll use this word very carefully, magical? Are they special rods that, you know, special things that because of whom they are, what they are, they do these things? No, it's God that's connected to it. God empowers the outcome. You put that rod, you put that stone in someone else's hands that's not doing what God says to do with it, and there's a different outcome. The reason that's important is to remember that this entire setup, and we're going to break it back down again in different ways, is a dwelling place to recognize whom? God. Do you and I have struggle with idolatry in the 21st century? That's a shake and nod moment. We do. All right. Did Israel struggle with idolatry in this century? Yeah. I mean, they just came out of a massively connected idolatrous practice where every nation around them was gathered together with their false gods and their false implements of worship. And they would struggle at times to break off from that and to separate themselves from that. And so with each of these aspects, a thing to remember is that it's not the Ark, it's not the holy place, It's not the Holy of Holies. It's not the tabernacle that they worshipped. They didn't worship those things. Well, let me rephrase that. They were not supposed to worship those things. But think forward. Did they struggle with that at times? Oh, yeah, they did. When they built the temple and it was destroyed, and they built the lesser temple as they thought of it a second time, how'd they feel about that? Well, this is so awful. The old temple was amazing, and we've built junk. Why did we do? Why is this one not so good? Okay, so I don't have the charts out here just because there's no real way to represent this, but tabernacle compared to the temple that David paid for and Solomon assembled. They both had a part in building the temple. Which one's nicer? Do they see them? Here's the way to think about it. When they complained about the second rebuilt temple, did they compare it to that tabernacle that they started with? No. But which one was nicer, the rebuilt temple or the tabernacle? Rebuilt temple, it's got walls. Exactly. And who dwelt in all three of them? God did. Yeah, Jehovah. And whose worship was accepted in all three of them? God was. That's a powerful point to catch here, because we'll see it again when we get forward in the history of God's people and we're making those contrasts. But you think about where they started from. And we mentioned this also Wednesday night. All the supplies to build this, all the precious items, God provided to them in part of their departure from Egypt, because all the nations around them says, here, take our stuff. All the gold, silver, you can have that. That fueled that. Just as much as David fueled by God's power the resources that Solomon used to build the physical temple. All of them, all three of them, were sanctioned by God. Tabernacle, Temple A, Temple B. God sanctioned them. God asked for the outcome to come to pass. And remember the prophets when they were building the temple? God complained when they didn't prioritize. I say complained. He instructed and admonished. They didn't prioritize the temple being completed first. Where do we worship? You know, that was the emphasis there. And so in practicality, they're all equal, like Steve pointed out, in God's perspective. They were all suitable. They were all effective. They were all useful. That's something for you and I to consider when we can think about our worship and the way in which we value things, the way in which we value our participation in worship. Because again, these aspects of the temple are shadows that appear in fullness in Christ. So we learn from this pattern a whole lot about God's attitude towards worship, His big plan for redemption, the arrival of the Christ. It makes us maybe be a little bit more mindful about thinking, what does God want, before we just offer up whatever seems right. Because all three of those were okay, even though they're three vastly different things. The shapes, same place, right? Layout, organization, same, similar. But there's no comparison of the three. A mobile tabernacle versus an incredibly ornate temple versus a rebuilt temple. All right, so let's pick up again in verse 10 of chapter 25, which is just in the introduction, if you will, to the Ark of the Covenant. It again specifies dimensions and width and size. 2 cubits and a half shall be its length, chapter 25, verse 10. You overlay it with pure gold. So acacia wood overlaid with gold is going to be the structure there. You'll make poles out of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. Rings on the side, you're going to carry the ark by that. The law goes in, the testimony that will be given to them. And so you have the structural side of its covering there. At the end of it, there's a little bit of information onto the detailing, if you will. That's the section I want us to read together. So let's read verses 17 through 22 together for right now. Let's see. Roy, do you want to read that for us? I saw you turn over there real quick. All right, so in the depiction of the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark that carries, the Ark that is connected to the covenant of God, a couple of details here. We have the two, and it's usually translated cherubim. It's from a Hebrew word that sounds real similar, kerovim, and that's the cherubim as we say it. That's how Hebrew and Greek to English usually ends up being that way. You know, really similar when you look at them. These two cherubim are angelic creatures. They are equivalent in the linguistic side to the messengers of God. That's what an angel is, by the way. Angel is a word that refers to the messenger role. And so someone who serves as a messenger is a variation of an angel. Angelos, if you think about it that way. But here they're described as serving as a pictorial role. And so on top of the Ark of the Covenant, you've got two messengers of God. Their wings are identified for us as part of this picture. And there's also this idea of mercy being in play, where we have this term, the mercy seat. And we've talked a little bit about that in our Roman study. We're not going to go into great detail here, but I want you to think about it from the standpoint of, as Israel is traveling, because that puts us in the context of the reason for a mobile place of worship. As Israel is traveling, and the Ark of the Covenant is on the shoulders of the men entrusted with the task, carried forth, they're going to see the law, the mercy seat, and messengers of God tied together every day. Now you think about how this the daily cycle of the wandering Israelites are. All right, and they make camp, they break camp. They make camp, they break camp. And in the midst of all of that, in the center part of it, where everyone is positioned, they can always turn and see the spiritual focus of their people. No matter where they may be, a huge, massive crowd in the middle of it is going to be the center of their worship. And in the middle of all of those things, in the highest spot of the things that they consider the most pure, holy of holies, separated from everything else, is an ark that they also get to see and hear about. And it has those key features. Messengers of God, God's standard and a reminder of mercy. Do you think of the old law as merciful? I'll tell you my answer to that, not always. I have to remind myself that the old law is more than one verse. If I look at one verse, sometimes I might see God's justice, His vengeance. But if I look at more than one verse, His justice, His vengeance, His judgment is often preceded by tremendous amounts of patience and forbearance. Far more patience than probably you and I have. And the easiest illustration is all the way back in the flood period. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 17 and 18 reminds us that while Noah built the ark, God waited patiently. The ark is the largest, the replication of the ark that's up in Kentucky is the largest freestanding timber frame structure in the world. It's massive. Noah and his family were involved in building the original ark. Was it a quick process? Yeah. And Noah was also engaged in preaching at the time by his actions, preacher of righteousness. Building the ark as a form of preaching of its own kind, but also telling people what God said is to come is the other half of the preaching side. As you build an ark, you're kind of telling people something's coming. When the walls of the structure get higher than the earth around it, it's like, oh, he's doing something. What's he doing? Patience is what that represents. God's patience. Patience to save Noah and his family. Patience for allowance for change. Allowance for the fullness of time to come to pass. And so, again, you see all those things. And Israel got to see God's mercy very often visually portrayed for them. Also understand this, one little tidbit. We have a little bit of a struggle sometimes in capturing the image of the cherubim because we have made them over into little babies. Cherubim, when we see them, we think about little baby angels. The Hebrew imagery there is not little babies. It's a term that would be applied to a creature that would be full grown and mature. So that's one of those imagery things that maybe we struggle with in capturing. And by the way, in Raiders of the Lost Ark, they actually do a pretty good job of avoiding that misrepresentation. Because most of what you see on that ark in the movie are the wings, which is actually most of what you probably would have seen in the actual creation of the ark itself, which was their wings curling over and their hands moving forward. So that structure there, as it's laid out for us, is the first representation of God having them engage in worship, not only here, but outward. Because as that ark goes forward, and you see it, you see the ark as it moves from place to place, it's connecting them to God outside of the, and I'll use this very generally, not specifically, outside of the church building, the tabernacle building, if you want to use that that way. Because now their worship is a daily thing, even though it was in other ways already, because of the structure of their relationship right now. Because they're going to see it, they're going to acknowledge God, they're going to see His mercy. The next few sections, particularly 23 through the end of this chapter, lays out for us some of the other physical furniture that's going to be used in their worship. The table of showbread or the bread table is discussed next in verses 23 through verse 30 or so. Then we also have the golden lampstand or a candlestick, which is verse 31 through 40. And they had continual value to them. And each of these things that are prayed out here for our worship, you've got some things that they were responsible to maintain on a regular basis, that they are to engage. And so you've got the the candlestick here, or the golden lampstand, and the table of showbread that would be present here inside the center section of their tabernacle. God expected those things to be maintained and sustained. And so as they're traveling through their journeys now, He's giving the Levite families and the leading families that would eventually take over these various roles the pretty significant responsibilities. Because, think about it in a very simplified sense, the covenant was expected to be followed. Break the covenant, what kind of consequences were there for Israel, for Israel violating the covenant? Well, one of the most simple ones is God's blessings roll off the table. His blessings of care, His blessings of compassion, His blessings of food and shelter for them right now, pretty literal. It's not even just providence of them being available, it's that He's giving them to them. So the person who is in charge of the candlestick, the golden lampstand, how difficult is that job? Is that like a really hard job to make sure it's lit? But how important is the job? It's like top of the list, right? Now think about our lives today. And this is a great spiritual parallel for us. Some jobs in our culture are incredibly difficult, right? Mentally challenging and physically challenging. But they may not necessarily be incredibly essential. Not every single job has the same level of necessity. On the other hand, there are some jobs that are super essential. Like, you've got to have that going. But they're not necessarily very difficult. Our culture sometimes values the incredibly challenging, incredibly difficult jobs. And I'm not talking about money, by the way. I'm talking about the value we say that job is worth to our self-being. We say, well, that's a really important job. This job over here, well, anyone can do that. But here's the reality. Anyone can't do that. Because this job over here that's really essential, really necessary, you know who you want in charge of that? The most reliable person you know. This person over here that's doing this job, really important. So when we start looking at the aspects of worship and the way in which the Levites are serving later down the road as they begin to adopt all of their fullness of their roles, their roles are vital to the success of Israel. Even if, and you think about this, do you think perhaps the farming kids of some of the tribes looked at the priestly kids of the Levites and says, all those Levites, all they do is wander around the temple every day. They don't know what hard work is. Is that a legitimate way in which people think about things sometimes? Particularly young people, but sometimes adults. Yeah. Our spiritual application then has to realize that if that makes sense, that that's a challenge. That's a challenge for us today too. And we need to make sure we value, and I'm not talking about jobs anymore. I'm talking about spiritual priorities and things of eternal weight. But yeah, they may not have the same challenge and difficulty of the complicated things, but they are so essential that if you don't get those right, all those other things over there, what's the point then? And then you synthesize it down to the beginning of the conversation that Moses had with Israel as God spoke to them. He gave them pretty concrete commandments. Standardized, big, principled ideas. And then he clarified them a little bit later in the next few chapters. You think about how, and here's the application side of the New Testament. Jesus and Paul and the apostles and the inspired men of the New Testament often made reference to things that were matters for the beginning part of your faith, or maybe milk, and the meat part of your faith as you matured. Paul even said sometimes you had to leave the meat, go back to the milk. Go back to the things that are vital, essential, so important that if you fail to keep them, anything over there on the meat table doesn't even matter anymore. Because you need the milk. You got to have that to begin with. And if you're over on the meat table and you've forgotten the milk stuff, so get back over on the right table where you need to grow the most and build that in there. I think it's powerful to think about that in a very simplified sense because for these Israelites there, a candle, a golden lampstand in the middle of a mobile tabernacle as they're moving from one place to another is not a huge thing, but it's part of a vital thing for Israel. It's vital because God asked for it. It's vital because it is connected to His holiness. And God wanted them to learn to be holy as He was holy. And so we can see, again, some of these things laying out the standard on the physical side. And one more thing to think about. All of this is a little bit of a hint of what's to come. We'll get to Revelation at some point, whether it be in this class series or maybe also in some other settings. But the text of Revelation, which is a very pictorial book. All of us love picture books, but none of us want to admit that we do. But picture books are awesome. We forget that Revelation is a picture book. The pictures are just drawn out for us with words. It says, remember this picture. It's like opening up a comic book. And there's a picture there. And the picture tells us the next story. And it tells us the next story. And Revelation pulls a lot of its pictures from the temple, from the tabernacle, and from the prophets of the Old Testament. It's a powerful picture book. And once we think about it in that way, I guarantee you it's going to be a lot easier to chew on. Because we'll be like, whoa, that's that picture. And I remember Israel going through that. And that's that picture over there. And that's I remember that one too. Those are some great aspects to that to catch as we're kind of looking at those two things. The next thing that takes place for us of note occurs in the beginning of chapter 26. And that's where the tabernacle's structure, physical structure, is starting to be built together. We see some indications of it here where we've got the layout of the post and lines that would hold it into place. I'm going to assume and clarify for this if I'm wrong, most of us have probably seen one of those traveling circuses or big tents they put up in the open spaces and how they use those giant lines to hold everything up. That's a great basic illustration of some aspects of how the tabernacle works. Not exactly, it's not a three-ring circus inside, obviously, but the principle of a large tent is pretty standardized. You got to put tension on it to build it up, and so some of that's included. And again, they're using that same wood. You've seen that appear a couple of times now. Acacia wood is the standard wood that's being used in this tabernacle. By the way, how long is this tabernacle going to last? Well, let's see, how long are they in the wilderness? Yeah. How long is it until David and Solomon come on the scene after this? The smart answer is more than 40 years. That's the answer that comes, okay. The detailed answer is not as important and as at the outset. Quite a long time. Quite a long time. You ever pulled out a 40-year-old tent? I have. Don't do that. But there's some other factors to consider. God has a hand in these things. And the 40-year-old tent that I had pulled out hadn't been used. And things that don't get used, they wear out, they rot, they smell bad. You think about the aspect of Israel and their faithfulness, especially during the periods between conquest and their demand for a king. Build up, we want a king! Give us a king like the nations around us. They had one, but their worship of him had diminished. Their worship of the king had gone off the rails, if you will. And yet most of these implements that we see find a place of appearance out of the same substances, same structures in the temple that will be built. But here you see them building the curtains, the boards, the bars. And in this section of chapter 26, you also have a layout provided for us of where everything is supposed to be positioned in the midst of the space. That becomes important because it's the standard by which the physical temple then follows through. It has that same basic layout, and the same basic approach to the worship. In verses 7 and following, we also begin, and this actually is part of the first few verses of chapter 2, we get some of those structures laid out. There's 10 curtains. There's a space being involved regarding the curtains, 28 cubits, 4 cubits. The arrangement of them together is 5. They're tied together as 1. The design, you see a reappearance of the cherubim or cherubim, the angels, the messengers of God, again, are having a place. The color is specified. My translation renders it for us blue, purple, and scarlet. That's my timer that reminds me of things. I keep forgetting to leave it here. I leave it off the table. And so those pictures there start giving us a sense of its place. Think about this. Blue, purple, and scarlet on this scale. In the midst of a Middle Eastern wilderness. Not a desert, but a wilderness. Surrounded by the entourage of Israel. All those people. Traveling through that whole peninsula region as they wander through that section of time. I think I've got part of it up here. And so you've got Israel eventually going to be bouncing through that wilderness region. In the center of their place is this brilliant stage of colors. Royal and vibrant as a contrast to the landscape that surrounds them. And there's a giant signpost pointing to the center part of Israel in their journeys, right? What guides them by day and night? Yeah, God does through the clouds of the fire. So start standing back for a moment. And this is one of those pictures of the Bible that are really important for you to try to visualize. We're not always good at it. We make some mistakes. But look off in the distance. And see Israel arrayed around the temple, the tabernacle they're building, the place of worship. And so you've got the tribes surrounding this large clump of events. And you've got, in the midst of this, a tent that rises up as they're building and designing and finishing it. Colors that flow, the purple, the gold that is everywhere and all the implements, the lights that shine and reflect. And this is the place that God is telling them is where He dwells. That's the other half of the picture of this story, is to understand that when we start to visualize it and we see that God is there, Israel saw that God was there. That this is described for them as a dwelling place for God to be close to them. We think about that, though, when Moses comes down from the mountain, was it obvious that he had seen God? It's like, you're glowing, you know, is the practical side of he's been somewhere. All right, all that gold that is connected to all of those implements of worship, all of the brilliant colors, all of God's handiwork involved in providing the background for it to take place. And now worship and sacrifice takes place there. So that's another aspect of seeing the biggest connection point of God's holiness visibly displayed for them. The outer curtains that are bring out the next phase of this. This is around the middle section of the 26th chapter. They're made out of goat's hair is the material that's used there. 11 curtains. These are larger, 30 cubits by 4 cubits is their span. 5, again, are coupled together as one. And there's one last outer curtain layer, if you will, that was placed over the goat's hair. And it was ram skins, red in color, and it is described as a sealing skin, if you will. I think some translations actually have that. So that's that outer layer side. This sets up a slightly different type of tent, by the way. I described it in one sense as one of those circus tents. But this has a little bit more structure to it, to the boarding nature of it. And so it's more of a significant structure mass, particularly when we think about wind pushing up against it. There's a lot more protection. And there's a practical side to that. If you think about God's plan to keep that Holy of Holies special, raise your hand if you've ever been camping with your family. So some of us know the challenge of keeping dirt outside of the tent from being inside the tent, right? And if your parents are like my parents, the standard rule was, take those shoes off. Does that actually work? It does not work at all. 100% of the time, it is a failure because the dirt comes on you the rest of the way. Now remember that in this sense when we think about God's plan here. He's created a set of layers that isolate this holy place. And it wasn't about dirt, per se. I'm sure that the Holy of Holies was very clean. It was about understanding the spiritual separation. Because the process by which they could go into this space later on in the temple, the process by which they maintained this place, was not about removing themselves from the dirt of the earth. That's just not possible. No human can accomplish that, no matter how hard we try. But it was helping them understand the spiritual separation that existed between them and God. And like we pointed out at the beginning of class, intentionally, the center point of all of that is a reminder of God's law, God's mercy, and the ability to communicate with God. There's a lot more in the imagery that takes place in this, but that's one of the most powerful ones we can leave with for this morning, is that even under the covenant, God put powerful reminders about His mercy, His standard, and His desire to connect with His people. Gary?
And one thing you mentioned about how important it was to build everything according to the covenant.
Yeah.
You just mentioned that again, but it's important.
Yeah. Yeah. Every single time God gives in the building of the tabernacle temple areas, whether it's temple phase, tabernacle phase, the standard comes into play. Build it to my standard. Do it to my expectations. Right. Show that's over there. Yeah. Right. That is correct, and I was incorrect also in running along with you on that. I quickly agreed and didn't think about it. So we've corrected that. Showbread, there's no record of the showbread being in the ark. It's just in the temple space proper. Manna was in there. Aaron's rod that budded, and the commandments, version 1, version 2, if you think about it in that sense. All right. That's it, time for our class, so we'll close off right here. And we'll be picking up looking at chapter 27 on Wednesday, talking about the production of the bronze altar, the court of the tabernacle layout, and some of the other factors. And chapter 28 brings into play the garments the priests were to wear. Thanks, everybody.